The impeachment of Donald Trump moves to the Senate. Witnesses? Maybe. Another big question, what happens if you have a conspiracy playing out in plain view?
If Donald Trump asks for something publicly and says, Russia, if you're listening, and then Russia goes off and does that, does that account for collusion or conspiracy?
Also today, Trump takes a victory lap for inking a trade deal with China, but many economists are not so impressed.
It's a small achievement at a very high price.
And an American craft beer company labels itself hip and progressive.
Most big beers are made in not-so-great industrial complexes.
But Fat Tire never sold out.
But some refugees from Southeast Asia say, Fat Tire, you did sell out. I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. Today, articles of impeachment were sent across the Capitol rotunda. The Senate will now pick up the impeachment trial of President Donald Trump for abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Here's Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi today making her case to the Senate.
What is at stake here is the Constitution of the United States. This is what an impeachment is about. The president violated his oath of office.
A lot of things are still up in the air, like whether former National Security Advisor John Bolton will be allowed to testify. Garrett Graff helped us today to unpack a lot of this. He's a national security journalist who covers the Ukraine scandal for Wired. I asked him about the new evidence the House Intelligence Committee released last night, documents from Rudy Giuliani's fixer for Ukraine, Lev Parnas.
What I think we saw come out of these documents was surprising, but not altogether shocking. What we saw were a mix of text messages and handwritten notes and communications between Lev Parnas, Rudy Giuliani, and others that hinted at just how much of a personal operation this really was in Ukraine, that there was no official sanction or U.S. foreign policy interest at stake here. This was Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, doing a personal mission for the president to push Ukraine to investigate a domestic political rival and potentially, you know, hold at bay U.S. foreign aid that would help Ukraine militarily.
So what would you want to hear from someone like John Bolton?
I think that John Bolton could go a long way towards unpeeling the fiction that, you know, this was some sort of anti-corruption expedition by President Trump, totally unrelated to Joe Biden personally, say that he is willing to testify if subpoenaed by the Senate. The man was at the heart of the White House operation during the time in question. Bolton could speak to what we now understand were rising and vocal concerns within the White House, within the Pentagon, within the Office of Management of Budget about the holdup over this aid and how seemingly at odds with congressional wishes it truly was. And so hearing that from him, forcing Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, another key figure in this who has remained silent, to be on record at least with his interpretation of these events, you can see that there could be some real value to bringing forward some of these perspectives.
Meanwhile, Garrett, there's Russia to talk about. Russian state hackers attacked the Ukrainian oil company Burisma Holdings, which just happens to be at the center of Trump's impeachment controversy because Joe Biden's son, Hunter, used to serve on the board of Burisma. What do you think prompted this cyber attack and why now?
The most cynical and interesting possible explanation for the Russian GRU attack on Burisma might simply be that Donald Trump has asked for it. He has made no secret for months now of his desire to see these Burisma Biden links investigated. He's turned on the White House lawn to asking China to investigate Biden as well. There's not necessarily any evidence for it except for the coincidence of timing that this attack is taking place right as Burisma moves to the center of the impeachment scandal. And by the way, this gets to sort of the heart of the questions that still linger around the Mueller report and the investigation of the 2016 attack. What happens if you have a conspiracy or collusion playing out in plain view? If Donald Trump asks for something publicly and says, Russia, if you're listening, and then Russia goes off and does that account for collusion or conspiracy?
So do you think we're going to see more Russian involvement like this?
I think we are certainly going to see more Russian involvement. And one of the things that I think most troubles me from a cybersecurity perspective and sort of the influence of foreign states in our election is why Republicans have not been more active on election security, because there is no guarantee that Russia will be the only nation state attempting these activities in 2020, nor is it necessarily clear that other nation states will back Donald Trump or the Republican Party in the 2020 election going forward.
Your question that you just kind of laid out a moment ago, what happens if you have a conspiracy playing out in plain view? I mean, how do you see that question playing out as this impeachment business goes to a Senate trial?
This really gets to the heart of why you've seen the House trying to move as quickly as it can on these articles of impeachment. This is different than the case that faced Richard Nixon after the 1972 election and the Watergate break-in, because that was a conspiracy in the past sense. You know, what worries Democrats is that what we are currently dealing with, what they have moved forward on in terms of articles of impeachment, talks about a conspiracy that is forward-looking. The idea of trying to rig the election still to come this year.
National security journalist Garrett Graff has been covering the Ukraine scandal for Wired. Thanks for being with us today, Garrett.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In Russia, the entire government resigned today on live TV. Pretty remarkable. The resignations included Russia's Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev. Reporter Charles Maines is in Moscow, and now there is a new Prime Minister, Charles. Who is it? And just help us understand what is going on with this political drama.
Yeah, it's been a wild day in Russian politics. It actually started off with Putin's State of the Nation address. It's an annual address he gives to the Federal Assembly here, in which he basically talked mostly about, you know, domestic issues, but then made this kind of wild turn at the end where he suddenly talked about constitutional amendments that he proposed. And they would essentially take power away from the presidency and give them back to the parliament. Now, why would he do that? Well, it seems tied to the fact that Putin's in his final and fourth term in office. And then we heard from Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev.
В этом контексте очевидно, что мы
saying, you know, given this shifting legal landscape, it doesn't make sense for the government to stay together. We need to support Putin with these reforms. So he was out. The whole government folded. And before we even had a chance to speculate on who might come next in his place, Putin announced that the new prime minister is a guy named Mikhail Mishustin. He's the little-known head of Russia's federal tax services, a guy basically nobody knows. None of my Russian friends seem to know much about him.
So why did this happen? I mean, Medvedev resigning, and I mean, he fired everybody else, right, in the Duma.
Well, there's Medvedev's resignation, of course, which is one issue. But then there's also the issue of this power play that's kind of behind the scenes here, which has been really the source of debate for months, which is what will happen when Putin's term ends in 2024. You know, the whole capital has been rife with speculation on this. But in terms of Medvedev, you know, he's always been a not a particularly popular figure here. He's been involved in various corruption scandals. He's been something of a millstone around Putin's neck.
So now Medvedev is the deputy head of the Security Council. So what does that mean? Is it a promotion or is it a demotion?
Well, I think it's more of a sense of loyalty that he's got this post. It's a strange name. He was already on the Security Council, so it's hard to call it a promotion. He lost his prime ministership. I think it's important to point out that within the Kremlin, or Vladimir Putin's Kremlin at any rate, you see this sense of loyalty kind of dominate above all else. Think back to, for example, the doping scandals around the Olympics, and the minister of sport who was involved in all of that got a promotion at the end of the day. So people tend to stick around.
And the reaction from the Duma members who'd all been fired, what happens to those lawmakers now? And I heard that many of them were not expecting this.
I don't think anybody was expecting it, but we certainly were expecting, you know, some of this, these movements, again, rumors about what might happen, how Putin might stay in power. We have to look back, frankly, to 2008. Remember, that's when Putin was, his first two terms in office were up. There was a two-term limit. So what did he do? He became prime minister for 4 years. Dmitry Medvedev, this prime minister who resigned today, assumed the presidency. So they seem to do all these machinations to try and keep within the spirit of the Constitution while maybe not exactly applying the letter of the law.
So just help me understand how Vladimir Putin would benefit from all of this kind of shuffling around in the long run.
Well, for one, he's got, again, a lot of his speech today focused on domestic affairs. He talked about, for example, their low living wages, the decline in the birth rate, their problems with education, healthcare. You know, this is the kind of stuff that he needs a prime minister to push through. It's not his forte. Medvedev has been in office now for several years. He's deeply unpopular. Again, there's corruption scandals around him as well. I guess this allows Putin to make the case that 20 years in office, he's still making changes to try and improve Russians' lives. In terms of the actual constitutional amendments that are going forward, and there's no doubt that they will go forward, this provides Putin anyway an avenue to keep his influence over the country. So before 2024, assuming that once power really shifts to the parliament here, Putin might take a role within the parliament. He could take a role as a super prime minister or perhaps something on the Security Council. These are all possibilities, and of course we don't know, but this seems to open the door to those options.
So Charles, does this show us that politics in Russia are often ad hoc, or is it Putin who appears to be improvising as he goes along, but in fact he's really engineering a grand scheme that we don't quite understand?
No, I think it is very ad hoc. You have to think of it this way. Vladimir Putin's been running the country for 20 years now, and still, there are no mechanisms available. You know, you don't have, there's no sense of what will happen in terms of a transfer of power. It makes everybody nervous. So in a sense, you could say that, well, he's become this great national leader to Russians. He's also built nothing in that period because there's so much uncertainty about what happens when he leaves.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow speaking with us about the Russian prime minister and government's sudden resignation there. Wild day in Russian politics, Charles. Thank you.
Thank you.
As Charles just mentioned, Vladimir Putin has been in power in Russia for more than 20 years. We put together a timeline of key events that have shaped his years as Russia's president, then prime minister, then president again. That's at theworld.org. Last Sunday, the Taal volcano in the Philippines erupted, and now some 20,000 people have been evacuated from an area near it. As scientists warn, another dangerous eruption could happen within hours. Despite the concerns, some people are returning home today to check on livestock. The BBC's Howard Johnson sent us this report from the city of Taguete, close to the Taal volcano.
We've come to visit a local community on the edge of the exclusion zone here who say the volcanic ash has destroyed their livelihoods. Now, looking around, it's grey everywhere. There's ash, thick ash on fallen trees. There's lots of branches on the floor, corrugated iron that's been ripped off roofs. And really, all you can see is the colour grey.
Margie and Noel Vergas own a small plot of land in the vicinity of Taal volcano. They grow vegetables and breed chickens for a living. But their lives were turned upside down on Sunday when the volcano began erupting.
Around 4 in the afternoon, we panicked. We saw a huge smoke cloud coming from the volcano and we could smell something awful. Ash began falling with small stones and soil. We evacuated because some people said that there would be a tsunami on the lake next to Taal. We became scared.
Noel is showing us his vegetable patch. He grows squash, but he says that the condition of these plants now are so bad that he can't harvest them and that he can't take them to market for sale. You can hear the wind in the trees, and what that's doing is displacing the ash from these palm trees. So right now I'm being covered in droplets of dried up ash. Initially it was quite wet, but now a lot of the ash is in the air and it's getting into people's lungs.
Concerns over the ill effects of breathing ash-laden air has prompted many people in the area to rush out and buy face masks. But for Margie, air quality is the least of her concerns.
We're still anxious because the volcano still spews smoke. Of course, what's happening in our area has hurt us, but we're thankful because our house is still standing.
The BBC's Howard Johnson there reporting on the eruption of the Taal volcano in the Philippines. China and the U.S. call for a timeout in the trade war. President Trump signed the deal at a White House ceremony today.
Today we take a momentous step, one that has never been taken before with China, toward a future of fair and reciprocal trade as we sign phase one of the historic trade deal between the United States and China.
In the deal, the Trump administration agreed to ease some tariffs on imports from China, and China has agreed to provide greater protections for American technology in China. China has also committed to buy more U.S. energy and farm exports. Illinois is a top soybean producer in the U.S. In a press release, the Illinois Farm Bureau called today historic, at the same time saying it was looking forward to more specific details on the deal and hoping to win back lost agricultural exports. Officials with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce said the agreement is a step in the right direction, but that there's a lot of work left to do. Many economists feel the same.
It's certainly good that, you know, we're moving away from a trade war. As Winston Churchill said, it's better to jaw-jaw than war-war.
Michael Klein is at the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He's also executive editor of EconoFact, a website where economists unpack complex topics for the rest of us.
It's been called more positive by the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, but an expert at the Council on Foreign Relations said that it's a small achievement at a very high price.
Well, the Trump administration did manage to wring some concessions out of China. One example, China is now promising to punish Chinese firms that steal corporate trade secrets. But just on that, what guarantees are there that they'll actually follow through and live up to their end of the bargain?
We really don't know. That's a very good question. We really don't know the answer to that. You know, these kinds of things have been going on for a long time, and it's a real concern that China forces companies to have joint ventures and then they take their technology. In the past, the U.S. Trade Representative 2018 under the Trump administration said that China has violated the agreement. So we don't have a way to guarantee that it's going to happen this time. And apparently there may be like a lot of loopholes. So the Chinese promises have been called broad and vague.
Will we, the public, ever know what those loopholes are?
After they're used, I suppose. Yeah.
I mean, China's also agreed in principle to buy $200 billion more of American goods over the next 2 years. First of all, is that possible? Can they just say, all right, 2 years of stuff on layaway, we guarantee we'll pay? And second, how much does $200 billion actually matter?
Well, the irony here is that the United States wants China to be more market-oriented, but then they're saying, and yet we want you to guarantee the purchases of these goods. There's a real question of whether or not they could even absorb that many goods. And it really, at best, could provide, you know, a temporary help to the United States manufacturing and agriculture. It's notable that, you know, the Trump administration has made essentially big welfare payments to agriculture because of the damage that the trade war has done.
Well, it's interesting. Amy Klobuchar last night at the debate spoke about people in Iowa who'd lost their jobs because of Trump's tariffs. She was talking about going to a food processing plant in Iowa, and basically there was only one person still working there.
That worker brought out a coat rack of uniforms, and he said, "These are my friends. They don't work here anymore." And their names were embroidered on those uniforms: Derek, Mark, Salvador. And that guy started to cry. These are real people hurt by Donald Trump's trade war.
So, Senator Klobuchar, there, farmers getting subsidies and processing plant workers losing their jobs. Is she citing an isolated example, or is she illustrating a wider trend with what Trump has done?
No, it's pretty broad. U.S. exports to China of agricultural goods fell by about 60% between 2018 and 2019. And but for government subsidies, agricultural production, value added, as economists call it, has been flat between 2018 and 2019. So it's a very broad thing.
Economists don't agree on a lot, but there is universal agreement, it seems, that tariffs are bad economics. What about the politics here? Did the president use tariffs, do you think, to basically get China to the table and stay at the table until an agreement was reached?
There's probably some element of truth in that. That's right. But also, people have ascribed the uncertainty associated with the way in which tariffs were imposed or taken off as dampening economic activity. It's effectively a tax on people. And, you know, you should think of a tariff as a tax because that's precisely what it is. And the question is, who bears it? And it turns out American businesses and consumers bear it.
Michael Klein is an economist at the Fletcher School at Tufts University and also the executive editor at the website EconoFact. Thanks very much for coming in.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Marco.
Speaking of tough on our wallet, here in the Northeast, winter is tough on our heating bills. It's also tough on the environment. Burning fossil fuels like gas and oil keep us warm, but also drive climate change. In the UK, heat for homes and buildings accounts for about a third of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. But scientists there are looking at a new energy blend. The BBC's Roger Harabin traveled to the English town of Keele to see the project.
I'm in the restaurant of Keele University. It is coming up to lunchtime and the kitchen is in full swing. What's new here, the ovens, the hot plates, the deep fat fryer, they're all running on a combination of natural gas with an injection of hydrogen. Michelle's on the deep fat fryer. Has it made a difference?
No, no difference at all. All the foods are being cooked in the normal way. There's no difference in taste. The machines are all performing as they normally would be.
So no difference in the kitchen, but there is a difference in greenhouse gas emissions. Thanks to the 20% injection of zero carbon hydrogen, there is, of course, a drop in greenhouse gases. But where does the hydrogen come from? Well, in the corner of the playing field, there's a glossy, green-painted mini-industrial complex. The hydrogen's being created in an electrolyzer here that splits water molecules into hydrogen and oxygen. It uses renewable energy, that's why it's zero carbon. Ed Sison is a consultant engineer. This trial is tiny, but he is thinking big.
The prize is a large one. If we were to roll out this technology across the UK, that would be about 6 million tonnes of carbon dioxide removed.
Hydrogen is much more expensive to produce than natural gas. But as climate change policies force up the cost of emitting carbon in future, it will look less expensive in comparison. And it may be especially suitable for areas with old housing stock that's difficult and expensive to insulate. So what would it take to make a boiler that ran on 100% hydrogen? Well, I've just come to visit Worcester Bosch, where they're working on just such a creature. We're coming into the research labs now. So I'm with Martin Bridges, who's technical director here. Martin, we're now in the research lab with the brightly coloured yellow extractor fans above and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 identical boilers. Is this spot the hydrogen boiler time?
Yes, more or less. Yeah, that was our intention. We purposely wanted to design a hydrogen firing boiler which would sit in the same footprint. Yeah, what you see is, to the outside eye, you know, hydrogen or natural gas, you wouldn't be able to tell the difference until you actually get inside it.
So this boiler, at the moment, will run on natural gas, and you can just change a few components, and the thing will be ready to run on hydrogen 100%.
Absolutely, yes.
That reporting from the BBC's Roger Harabin. Iran is ramping up its nuclear activity and backing out of its side of the deal, but that doesn't mean Iran will build a nuclear bomb in secret.
If Iran is committed to building a nuclear weapon in this all-out scenario, we will know it.
Ernest Moniz, one of the players behind that deal, weighs in. That's next here on The World. The nuclear deal is not dead yet. That's at least what Iran is saying. Since President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the 2015 nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, Tehran has gradually taken steps to reduce its compliance. Now, according to a new assessment by Israeli military intelligence, Iran could have enough enriched uranium to build a 90-pound nuclear bomb by the end of 2020. Former Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz was one of Obama's principal negotiators on the nuclear deal. He joins us from Washington. So according to Israel's military, Iran could have a nuke within the year. How credible is that assessment, in your opinion?
I think that's completely misleading. I remind you that the Iran agreement had the restriction on Iran's activities enforced in a way that there was a so-called one-year breakout time. That is, if Iran were to go full out from the place that they were under the agreement, they could make enough material for a bomb in no less than 1 year. The end of this year is nearly a year. And obviously, they have already taken steps away from some of the constraints. So that breakout time right now is somewhat less than 1 year.
So why do you think Israeli intelligence would not take those facts into consideration when making this assessment?
Oh, I think they have. So what I'm saying is the statement is not a very profound statement. All it's saying is that there was a one-year breakout time. It's been somewhat eroded. That's clear. However, the more important part of the agreement is the verification measures where the international inspectors from the International Atomic Energy Agency have unparalleled tools to watch everything going on in the program, even following the uranium all the way from mine to enrichment plant. So the question is, if Iran is committed to building a nuclear weapon in this all-out scenario, we will know it, and then it's up to the United States and others to decide upon the response, including a potential military response. Nothing was taken off the table in the Iran agreement.
Well, despite Iran's recurring claims that its activities are being supervised by the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA has claimed that Iran is violating the deal, and that was before Iran's decision to fully abandon its commitments. So how is the world following Iran's activity?
Iran has taken, by announcement, five steps to lower their compliance. They said this back in, starting in March, they took the first step. And 8 months later, they took the fifth step. Once they took the very first step, they were violating some part of the agreement. And the IAEA can verify it. It's a kind of a little ironic twist that they can verify compliance and they can verify non-compliance. So in that sense, Iran was not hiding anything. They were being transparent. Foreign Minister Zarif emphasized this again quite recently, that every step they've taken, they consider to be reversible. They have more heavy water than they are allowed under the agreement. Well, if the agreement is back, they can easily get rid of that heavy water. They have enriched uranium beyond the 300 kilogram limit. Well, they can easily get rid of that. So again, they have clearly left open the option of going back to the agreement fully if everybody goes back to the agreement fully.
Ernest Moniz was the Secretary of Energy under Barack Obama and helped negotiate the Iran nuclear deal. He's now with the Nuclear Threat Initiative in Washington. Secretary, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Israeli jets bombed a military base in central Syria last night, killing several pro-Iranian fighters. Israel generally refuses to confirm news reports about these sorts of military operations, but the attack last night appears to be the first Israeli strike against Iranian allies since the U.S. killing of Iran's top military commander, Qasem Soleimani. The animosity between Iran and Israel, it's nothing new, and it creates real anxiety for Iranian Jews who live in Israel. As Naomi Zeveloff reports from Tel Aviv, they find themselves caught in the middle of a conflict between two homelands.
In South Tel Aviv, customers file into the Shamshiri restaurant for a late afternoon lunch. The owner, Avi Khanasov, lists off the items on the menu.
Persian food, gome sabzi, chelo kebab, juje kebab, khoreshte musamma badinjum, khoreshte alu, all the kind of Persian food.
Khanasov was born and raised in Israel, but he grew up eating Persian cuisine and speaking Farsi. His parents came during the first big wave of Jewish immigrants from Iran, before the 1979 revolution.
Even my parents came 50 years ago and we born in here, we know all the culture.
He opened Shamshiri with his mother in 2001. It's since become a popular spot for Israeli Jews with Iranian heritage. They come here for a taste of the old country that's no longer possible to visit. About 200,000 Israelis have Persian roots. But the two nations are longtime foes. Iran cut ties with Israel after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Tens of thousands of Iranian Jews immigrated to the Jewish state in the second big wave of immigration. Orly Noy is one of them. She was born in Tehran and left during the revolution.
As part of the Jewish minority community in Iran, my parents thought that since, you know, everything was so chaotic at the time and we didn't know how it was going to evolve, then the first thought was to at least get the children, my brother and myself, out of Iran.
Noy is a translator of Farsi literature to Hebrew. Like many Iranian Jews in Israel, she has kept in touch with family in Iran. There are still thousands of Jews living there. It's one of the only Middle Eastern countries, aside from Israel, with a large Jewish community. After the United States killed Iranian commander Qasem Soleimani, Israel's prime minister applauded the move. Israel's security forces went on alert. But Noy worried about her relatives in Iran. They traded messages on WhatsApp.
I just sent, you know, how are you guys doing? And they said, well, we hope for the best, and we hope that things don't deteriorate and that everybody is, keeps safe, but not much more elaborate than that.
They have to be careful because Iran's government sees Israel as an enemy.
You know, you need to be smart when you speak and always take into consideration that somebody might be, monitoring the conversation and never do anything that might put them in any sort of danger.
In spite of the risks, some Jews from Iran actually visit Israel by traveling through a third country. But these trips are apparently becoming more rare. Iranian Jews in Israel say they hope for a day when they can go back to visit. Until then, they're intent on keeping the memory of Iran alive. But it's a memory of a country that in some ways no longer exists. In his Jerusalem office, Tzion Hasid plays a CD of Iranian Jewish music. He's the head of an organization of Iranian immigrants to Israel. On his office wall, there's a flag with a lion and a sun. It's the national flag Iran used before the revolution. He says the music makes him nostalgic for those days. I'm glad that I was born in such a country, he says. It was free and pleasant to live there, thank God. There were singers, there was history, there was culture, there was education. He left Iran in 1963. He says he faced anti-Semitism there, but he was also a Zionist and dreamed of living in the holy city of Jerusalem one day. Today, Hasid says he feels no clash between his Iranian and Israeli identities. He tells a story, it might be a legend, about the former Israeli ambassador who served in Iran before the revolution. Like Hasid, the ambassador was both Iranian and Israeli, and he refused to choose between the two countries. Hasid tears up a bit as he repeats what he says were the ambassador's words. I have two eyes, a left eye and a right eye. I can't distinguish between the two. I love both of my eyes, Iran and the land of Israel. For The World, I'm Naomi Zevaloff in Tel Aviv.
The strict new immigration policies that have taken hold over the past few years have made the lives of immigrants that much harder. I could be talking about the U.S. This also applies to Japan. Japan now has some of the strictest immigration policies in the world. And that makes one city outside of Tokyo all the more extraordinary. Kawaguchi has become something of a sanctuary city, but the protections only go so far. Matt Katz of WNYC went to Kawaguchi to find out more.
Aizo Aida says, I'm just the second American to ever sit down at his sushi bar in Kawaguchi City. The last person from the U.S. was a journalist, too, in town to cover the Tokyo Olympics in 1964. Aida says the journalist ate everything he ordered, which shocked him. The chef is now 82. He's been rolling sushi since just after World War II. Things are different now. Aida's loyal customers have been coming in with questions. They tell him that on the way to his restaurant, they're seeing more foreigners speaking mysterious languages loudly. And the last time Chef Aida went to Kawaguchi City Hall, he even saw people from Africa and South America there. So is this Kawaguchi City Hall?
Yes, this is a Kawaguchi City Hall.
I'm here to meet the mayor of Kawaguchi, Nobuo Okunoki, and I'm escorted by a translator.
So how should I address him?
Shicho.
The city attracts immigrants with its cheaper rent and lots of jobs in demolition and healthcare. Japanese language skills, not required. When I sit down with Mayor Okunoki, he says about 6% of the population, 35,000 people here, are immigrants. That's extraordinarily high for Japan, which has restricted immigration for centuries. Okunoki also mentions the immigrants here who've sought political asylum, including Kurds who fled Turkey. But Japan only grants refugee status to less than 1% of applicants, so many live without documentation or in a quasi-legal status. That's where Mayor Okunoki comes in. He funds education for children without papers, including free after-school Japanese lessons. He also helps fund health insurance for immigrants who can't join Japan's national program. It's pragmatic politics. The mayor says companies in his town are facing a severe labor shortage, just like the rest of Japan. They need immigrant workers. Of course, this is not without controversy. The mayor hears complaints about immigrants who, for example, don't follow the country's intricate garbage disposal rules. At the same time, the city has created a center that's filled with pamphlets that advise Japanese on how to help and understand and be friends with immigrants.
And here's another flyer called Friendship News.
There's also info on civic events, anything to help acclimate newcomers.
In Kawaguchi, we have many different countries' friends that are living here.
Jinghua Wang is the coordinator for international relations in Kawaguchi.
So we want the old Japanese people understand how they can live better with the foreign people.
Wang explained that one way to live better with foreigners is to tell them to lower their voices. She says the complaint that immigrants in Kawaguchi hang out in large groups, disturbing the quiet of Japanese life, is common. So one of the pamphlets tells Japanese how to say, "Please be quiet," in a variety of languages. Wang is originally from China, and she used to live in the U.S., which she sees as a model for a multicultural Japan.
In the state, many people, they use their own language, and they can keep their own culture. Yeah, I think right now we can do it also in Japan.
But such talk of a diverse Japanese future met a harsher reality when I visited a Kurdish family in Kawaguchi for dinner one night. We ate on an ornate blanket on the floor, Kurdish style. Next to each plate were chopsticks, Japanese style. The family asked me not to use their real names. They're seeking asylum from Turkey, where they say they'd face possible persecution and mandatory military conscription if they return. Japan has repeatedly denied them refugee status, but they're still trying. Only the family's uncle has a long-term visa.
No Kurds have ever gotten asylum in Japan. Are you hopeful that your family is going to be able to stay here?
No, he tells me. Even though he's lived in Japan peacefully for decades, he doesn't feel accepted. I also talked to his nephew, who asked to be called Johnny for this story. He tells me how he wants to be the first in his family to win refugee status. He spent most of his young life here. He learned Japanese playing baseball with classmates. After dinner, Johnny sat on the couch next to his girlfriend, their bare feet lightly touching. She's from Vietnam. They've been together 6 years, met in high school in Kawaguchi.
Love so much.
They want to get married, but Johnny faces deportation. Under Japan's immigration rules, he can't even leave the Kawaguchi area without permission from immigration authorities. He says those limits got him rejected from the college of his choice, out of concern that it would affect his attendance. And he's not allowed to work legally either. He won't discuss how he makes ends meet, but many Kurds work off the books, doing construction and demolition. Jobs the city's mayor said they need more people to do. Johnny sees himself as Japanese. If given the chance, he believes he can enrich Japan. But a Kurdish man and a Vietnamese woman, speaking Japanese, eating Kurdish food with chopsticks, maybe one day raising Japanese children. Their path is not easy in Japan, at least not yet. For The World, Matt Katz, Kawaguchi City, Japan.
If the name Fat Tire sounds familiar, you're either a mountain biker or a fan of craft beer. Beer geeks love Fat Tire, and the Colorado brewery that makes it has a great reputation, not just for making good beer, but for being socially responsible. That reputation is under a cloud, though. Thanks to a recent corporate sale, the brewery is now linked to one of the most notorious militaries in Asia. From Bangkok, here's The World's Patrick Nguyen with that story.
The army of Myanmar is known for waging brutal jungle warfare against its own people. Huge parts of the country are run by rebel groups, defending the homeland of various ethnic minorities. And the army has tried to conquer these places, often ruthlessly. We're talking torture, bombing villages. Take it from Ene Tha. He's from one of the country's minority groups, the Karen people.
We came from a place that everybody treated us like animal.
When he was 2 years old, in 1997, the army fired mortars into his village, presumably trying to flush out rebels. So his mom grabs him and his brother and flees, running for their lives in the jungle.
And my mother was 5 months pregnant at the time.
5 months pregnant.
I have experienced the ugly truth under the Burmese military.
Ne Thaw uses the former name of the country, Burma. Now, stories like this are not rare. In fact, the army was just on trial at The Hague, facing charges of genocide against yet another minority group, the Rohingya, which is why foreign companies generally want nothing to do with Myanmar's military. And yet, through a web of corporate ties, that army is now linked to one of America's biggest craft breweries.
Most big beers are made in not-so-great industrial complexes. But Fat Tire never sold out. Our employees own 100% of the company and only make Fat Tire with high-quality, natural ingredients in small batches.
Fat Tire Beer, made by New Belgium Brewery, based in Colorado. Now, that ad is from 2018. Just last month, this happened.
Employees at New Belgium Brewery in Fort Collins have officially voted to sell their business. The Fort Collins-based New Belgium was an employee-owned company. Employees approved the sale to a subsidiary of Japanese beverage company Kirin.
Kirin is a mega huge beer maker in Asia. They wanted New Belgium because New Belgium sells a lot of beer, but they also have a great reputation. One of their breweries runs on wind power. They give to environmental causes. You can come to work with piercings and tats. The company was also voted one of America's best places to work for millennials. Just look them up. You'll see all the stuff about how they are really progressive and nice. But Ne Thaw from Myanmar, he says,
you know, they have these labels. However, doesn't matter how much label you have on the news, if you're going to sell this company to a company that have relationship with the Burmese military, I don't buy those labels for a second.
He's talking about Kirin and its links to Myanmar's army. Just to back up a bit, Kirin has been making beer in Japan for more than 100 years. But Japan sales are dipping, so they've been buying up smaller breweries around the world, like New Belgium of Colorado, and several years ago, the top beer in Myanmar, called Myanmar Beer.
From glorious peaks to sun-baked plains, jungle-cloaked hills to magnificent beaches, our handcrafted beers reflect the flavors and colors of this beautiful golden land.
That's an ad for Myanmar Beer, and it is brewed by a group that is not progressive at all. It's an opaque corporate arm of Myanmar's army, called Myanmar Economic Holdings Limited. They're into everything from jade mines to chemical factories. And together with Kirin, they make Myanmar Beer.
Together with Kirin, we will create a workplace where people are inspired to build a happier society.
Right, so that's the link between this cool brewery in the U.S. and that notorious army in Asia. They aren't partners, but they are far-flung corporate cousins. Ne Thaw says, okay, if paying for a Fat Tire at all helps Myanmar's army buy even one more bullet, is it worth it?
There's no denial that they are, in essence, contribute financially to the military atrocity against ethnic minorities.
New Belgium wouldn't talk to me on the phone, but they did send a statement to me saying they are still proud to be an ethical organization, and that, quote, this news is certainly unsettling. Meanwhile, Kirin is reviewing its connection with Myanmar's army. New Belgium says maybe they can make things better now, because their CEO has a, quote, seat at the table in identifying a path forward. That CEO is named Kim Jordan, and Ne Thaw wrote her a letter.
It was sincere and genuine. I was speaking not as a Korean person asking a fellow American for help.
That's right, a fellow American. Ne Thaw is now 24 and living in Kentucky because his family made it to the U.S. as refugees more than 10 years ago. People from Myanmar are actually one of the biggest refugee groups living in the U.S. Ne Thaw says they're disappointed and not going to be drinking much Fat Tire anytime soon, but they're hoping that the brewery will somehow make this right. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Small British town experiences string of unsolved crimes. Could be a PBS drama, but in the village of Blackhawk Colliery in northeastern England, this happened. Since 2014, residents have been finding bundles of cash just in the middle of the street. We're talking piles of 20-pound notes. That's the equivalent of more than $2,500 at a time, nearly $35,000 spread out over the years. Police were stumped, but now the culprits have come forward. It was actually Good Samaritans. Here's local policeman John Forster.
It's an unusual thing to do, but they have left the money out to be found by people who they've almost targeted. So the money's been found by the people they wanted it to be found by.
Forrester said the Samaritans would identify retirees or people in need. Then they'd place the cash in public places, often right on the pavement, then stick around for the pickup.
And it sounds like they've left just a few seconds to enjoy the moment and to confirm it's being picked up by the people they wanted it to be picked up by.
Wow, imagine you suddenly get $2,500 out of the blue. The Good Samaritans want to remain anonymous. Only the police know their true identities. We do know it's two people. They told police they'd come into some unexpected windfalls and simply wanted to give back. Now other residents of Black Hawk Colliery, like Claire Doherty, are taking note.
People are now realising there's many, many genuine people out there. There's more people definitely coming to Black Hawk now, seeing if they can find this money.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a risk when people find out money grows on trees or serves as a road bump. Anyway, it is good to end on a kind note today. Signing off now from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here. We're back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.